May it please the court, counsel. And Your Honor, I intend to reserve approximately one half of my argument for rebuttal.
7.5 minutes? Okay.
7.5 minutes. So we'll see if I hew to that, but that is my goal. And I'd like to start off by telling the court exactly why the trial court should be reversed. Two major reasons. One, the trial court, instead of following the well-traveled standards and policies of the interpretation of insurance policies in Colorado, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, deviated from that standard and created a whole new rubric for fidelity bonds, which seems to go over to the other side, and instead of the decades and decades of Colorado law saying they're adhesion contracts, construe in favor of the insured, if there's an ambiguity, construe in favor of the insured.
Did the trial court find there was an ambiguity?
The trial court found that there was no ambiguity.
There was no ambiguity. Well, if there's no ambiguity, why would you construe it in favor of the insured?
I think notwithstanding an ambiguity or not, that exclusions are always to be construed narrowly, and that the policy is supposed to be construed in favor of coverage. But also, Your Honor, my next point is that the trial court erred by finding that there was not an ambiguity, and I'm going to explain exactly why there is an ambiguity. Probably should have said that first. And I want to turn first to the trial court's order and explain a little bit what I mean about this deviation from Colorado standards. The trial court, who to his credit had an oral argument and apparently spent a lot of time with this and wrote as good an opinion as you're going to get from a trial court in terms of the analysis he did. Unfortunately, I just think he's wrong. Hope you gentlemen agree with me. He starts on a good foot, the trial court judge. Page 4, he says, an insurance policy is a contract, the interpretation of which is a matter of law. It's supposed to be construed to promote the intent of the parties, and the courts look to the plain language, fairly black letter, if not extremely black letter. Had he stayed on that track, I think he would have been okay. But you skip from 4, and then from 4 to 6 is a discussion of this surety bond, fidelity bond thing. We dropped that. That's not an issue here. I can explain that if we have time. But once we got our assignment, at least in our view, bringing a direct claim based on a sure statutory surety bond was no longer necessary because we had an assignment of the assured's rights. The assured is the same thing as an insured, but I guess that's what they call it in fidelity bonds. And so that kind of takes that other analysis, at least from our perspective, off the table. So then we go to page 6 where the insuring clauses of the bond are discussed.
The question, though, is whether the company is insured for the risk that ultimately you're suing on.
That's exactly correct.
Now, that is the bad behavior, for lack of a better term, of its employees and in either marketing the investments or in managing the investments.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And where I think the trial court got off track was in its interpretation of MassMutual life insurance, and I'll explain why that case supports us as well. But the troublesome part is the court said that fidelity bonds are instruments of commerce with relatively standardized terms, and their language should be construed with appropriate regard for the value of uniform interpretation. And in arriving at that, the MassMutual court cited an article, which in our reply brief I asked the court to take judicial notice of. The article is cited in the MassMutual case. And so I'm asking the court to take judicial notice under Rule 201 of the source of that article, just like I would ask you to take judicial notice that a Kentucky Court of Appeals case was authored by the Kentucky Court of Appeals. Here, the judge, in arriving at this notion of standardization,
normally take judicial notice of facts. We don't take judicial notice of facts, but we'll read anything cited in the briefs.
And maybe it's not judicial notice. Maybe I'm using a misnomer. Maybe it's just a description.
Just ask us to read it. Just ask us to read it. We'll be happy.
Please,
we'll be happy.
What's key is in arriving at that notion that instead of fidelity bonds being construed as contracts, as is held at least by the FDIC versus Union Pacific case, which specifically says that fidelity policies are construed as insurance contracts, and numerous cases in Colorado say insurance contracts are construed as contracts, looking at the contract in front of you and not basing it on standardized terms around the industry. For that proposition, the court cited the article I'm talking about by the Fidelity Law Journal. Fidelity Law Journal is an industry publication put out by the Fidelity Law Association and doesn't even admit people who aren't in the fidelity bond industry. So it's clearly a document that advocates for the fidelity industry. Notwithstanding that, the MassMutual case did eventually come to the conclusion that some losses are covered under this type of language and some losses are not. And the key is whether the assured has control of the property that was lost. The only thing I'll dwell about in the facts is that in this case, my clients invested their money and gave their money to the assured.
What with it? To invest it, right?
To invest it.
Not to hold it as a deposit like a bank.
Well,
not to hold it as a deposit like a security broker, which are the cases that they're citing, right? To invest it.
No, not to invest it. To loan it.
Okay.
To loan it on very specific terms, based on representations that were made to my clients.
Isn't that just a form of investment?
Well, they're putting the entire package.
They were given the funds to manage.
They were given the funds to make real estate loans.
They were given the funds to manage, as opposed to an attorney's trust account, where you just hold the funds for someone. And your duty is to return them when
this is not a bailment situation, right, where you have to distinguish between a discrete pool, right, of funds and money that's fungible. This money was commingled, but based on the cases, like the RBC versus Dane Rauscher case and the Continental case, I don't see that as a distinction that's being made. The question is whether the money came in and went out in a dishonest
what
way.
What is the phrase direct loss mean?
Well, had the carrier defined it, I would know. Barring that, it could mean a couple different things. And backing up, I think all of these cases, and I'm sure the court is well schooled in the distinction between first party claims and third party claims, and that's become an issue here. And I'll explain this quickly the best I can, and then I'll defer my time. A first-party claim is like a bad faith claim or a claim under a fidelity bond. Say there's no assignment and the assured had just brought a claim under the fidelity bond. First-party claim is a claim between the insured and its carrier. A third-party claim is one that when somebody smashes my car and there's a liability and so on and so forth.
Counsel, when your client took an assignment or got an assignment of CCI's interest in this bond, did it gain any more rights than CCI had?
Absolutely not.
So it has the same rights CCI has?
Correct.
It has the right to recover for direct financial loss?
Yes.
So the case depends on whether or not this incident is a direct financial loss. Isn't that what this case depends on?
That is exactly correct.
And you say that term is ambiguous, and the other side says it's not ambiguous. And that's really what we have to decide, isn't that right?
That's exactly right.
And if we decide that term is not ambiguous, that's the end of the case as far as your client's concerned?
That's a fair statement, Your Honor.
And if we decide it's not ambiguous, as Judge Daly pointed out, we don't construe the policy in favor of your client based on any principle of law.
If the language is clear and the intent can be derived from four corners of the document, that's exactly correct.
So what's ambiguous about direct financial loss, which is, I think, where you're going?
That's exactly where I'm going, Your Honor, and thank you. Within that range, we took this assignment, so we're standing in CCI's shoes, and so this is a first-party claim. And I think that there's some confusion that's arisen because within first-party claims, the cases describe a variety of different types of situations, and some find liability and some don't. The two basic areas are some cases hold that if an assured incurs liability to a third party based upon the misconduct of the fraudster at the assured, that is sufficient for a third party loss. That is sufficient for a direct loss under the policy. Then, and for those propositions, I would cite the court to RBC versus Bain Rauscher on page 15 of our opening brief, Continental Savings versus U.S. Fidelity on page 16 of the brief, and FDIC versus United Pacific, also on page 16 of the brief. And those cases, well, most of them hold that they're situations where somebody has put money under the control of somebody else, like here. Those cases hold, although one of them does hold, but simply in the context of liability, that liability from a third party can be the trigger that creates loss. The other courts take a much narrower view, and we've actually cited some of those. So that's on page 17.
Is that liability to a third party been established?
I'm sorry?
Has the liability to the third party been established?
No, we were going to be trial. We had a plan that the trial court approved of. We were the cases against the underlying third party, as well as the insurance company. And the insurance company moved for summary judgment, saying we want to get a determination of liability first. And there was a lot of haggling back.
You're well into your reserve time. I don't want to keep you there if you don't want to be there.
That's very good. Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to finish that part up by saying that the other type is the very narrow type. The other first party loss doesn't include third parties at all. That's straight embezzlement. That's not what happened here. This was not somebody embezzling money out of the safe. This was one of the third party type losses described in the cases that I've cited. Since direct loss can be interpreted in both of those different ways, it's ambiguous and should be construed in our favor.
Is it ambiguous as a matter of law simply because other courts disagree as to its meaning?
No, that's discretionary with this court. And so courts disagree in the Thompson versus Maryland case. Says a couple things. It says if a claim, it says, and this is interesting because it says it in the disjunctive, it says if a term is undefined or otherwise ambiguous, it is ambiguous.
That Colorado case?
That's Thompson versus Maryland. It's a Colorado case. And based on that disjunctive, I think that case says, and it's good law, that if a term is undefined, that it's ambiguous.
Many terms in a document are undefined, but we don't say they're ambiguous, right?
I'm just referring to the case, Your Honor.
All right.
I can point you to the specific language.
I'm just suggesting that the fact that a term is not defined in a contract cannot possibly mean that every term that's not defined is ambiguous. There are certainly words that automobile, when used in a policy, is probably not ambiguous.
This is 84P3rd 496, and I understand what Your Honor is saying, but I also have a case in front of me that I believe is good law that says, when a general language in an insurance contract is undefined or is otherwise ambiguous, we construe it against the insurer and interpret it according to its plain meaning. Maybe that doesn't make sense in all contexts, but that's what the case says. And I understand it's discretionary, Judge Daly, within the court. None of these things, even the way it's phrased in Thompson, are absolute. However, I would say that take three things. One, I just explained how it can be interpreted in two different ways. Two, the courts are wildly divergent, as both the parties point out. And three, it's an undefined term. I'll reserve the rest of my time unless the court has any questions.
Bailiff, would you restore 2 minutes to the appellant and add 2 minutes to the appellee? And you'll have 3.5 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
That's the only authority I have. It's over the top.
I appreciate your exercising in that fashion, Your Honor. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you. morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Chris Novak. I represent underwriters at Lloyd's in this dispute. I'm going to talk mostly in response to some of the issues that the court has raised with the appellant this morning. One thing that I think is very important in terms of construction is that although the court, the trial court, Judge McNulty, recognized the need for uniform construction of fidelity bonds as they are a financial instrument, the court did not base its ruling on a reliance on uniform interpretation standards. The trial court ruled that based on the plain meaning of the operative terms of the bond, there was no coverage for the plaintiffs in this case. And I'll refer your honors to the judge's opinion in the record, it's page CD 1384. Judge McNulty held, quote, the plain language of the bond protects the assured CCI for direct losses to CCI as a result of employee dishonesty. Thus, the trial court held that by these plain terms, only CCI may proceed to recover under the bond for direct financial loss to itself. And this is really the distinction between first party and third party coverage.
But doesn't the definition of fidelity bond as used in the industry basically say that?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. And in fact, the bond at issue before you goes even a little bit further than the standard Fidelity Form 24 bond. The bond at issue before you, in its preamble, with respect to Insuring Clause 1A, and that's the insuring clause we're dealing with here, states that underwriters hereby undertake and agree to indemnify the insured for loss to the insured. That's in the preamble. When you go to the insuring agreement, our bond does not just contain direct loss language, which is often limited to the causative element of a fidelity bond, meaning was the loss a direct result of the dishonesty of the employee. Our bond actually uses the phrase twice. The bond before you provides coverage for direct financial loss by the direct financial loss sustained by the insured. So it's not just direct financial loss, it's direct financial loss sustained by the insured by reason of and directly caused by employee dishonesty. It is clear from these operative terms that what is meant by this insuring agreement is first party coverage.
It can't be assigned? Are you telling us this can't be assigned?
Yes, and I'm happy you raised that, Your Honor. There seems to be a misunderstanding about the assignment on the part of the appellants. In receiving the assignment, the appellants step into the shoes of the assignee, meaning they become CCI. In their brief, they seem to be arguing, and they seem to be arguing here, that they actually are the insured under the policy now. And that's not accurate, actually. CCI is still the assured. So when we talk about first-party loss as opposed to third-party loss, what we're talking about is the underlying claim. A third-party loss means that the insured has sustained a liability to a third party, as opposed to a first-party loss, which means the insured itself has sustained a loss.
CCI has not sustained such a loss yet. They concede that, right?
CCI has not sustained such a loss. What the plaintiffs are arguing by implication is that either, one, they become the insured under the policy, which is not accurate, or two, once CCI pays the third-party liability, that third-party liability then becomes a first-party loss. And the fact is that type of interpretation stands the idea of first-party insurance coverage on its head. It means that all losses become first-party losses once the insured pays the loss, even if that loss is incurred via a liability to a third party.
Now, normally in a liability, I mean, they want this fidelity bond to become a liability policy. And normally in liability insurance, the insurance company becomes involved in defense, may be required to provide the defense, but should be at least involved in the defense. Is there any language in this policy that says that?
Not with respect to this insuring agreement. There are insured units that were not purchased by the insured here. This is a blended bond. So it also includes under the D1 coverage, coverage for professional liability. That coverage was not purchased by CCI. That coverage has a defense obligation. It is more akin to what would commonly be understood as professional liability insurance. It's an excellent question, Your Honor. The fact is, under the A1 coverage, there is no duty to defend because it operates in a completely different way. With first-party coverage, you have a first-party loss that is sustained by the insured. The insured then presents a proof of loss wherein it has to satisfy the elements of coverage and then be indemnified for that loss by the insurance company.
So, assuming that the plaintiffs in this case had gotten a judgment against CCI before they made any of these claims, would that be, and CCI paid it, would that be a direct financial loss sustained by CCI, no, directly caused by an employee dishonest act?
It would not, because the loss itself would have been incurred via a liability to a third party. The loss that the plaintiffs are seeking here is the loss on their investments. The loss on the money, on the loss that was caused by CCI's failure to pay back the promissory notes. That's a liability that CCI has to a third party. It is not CCI's money.
It's not a direct loss.
That's right, Your Honor. And this actually gives you a good opportunity to talk about MassMutual and this idea about covered property. The fact is, since direct financial loss language was added to Fidelity bonds in 1980, and just as a side, it was done because previously the language that was in Fidelity bonds merely related to causation. It provided that coverage would be provided for acts through employee dishonesty. This through language was interpreted by some courts to mean that that coverage could then be extended to third-party liabilities, which was never intended by the industry. The industry responded to that by amending the wording of the standard bond to include direct financial loss language to make sure that the coverage could not be misinterpreted.
Why didn't it then define it?
I'm sorry?
Why did it not then define it? That's going to add it.
Because I think direct financial loss sustained by an insured is a definition. It requires no further elaboration. It fits with all the insuring agreement, with the exclusions, with the preamble. When you read the policy as a whole, it does not require a definition of, for example, what direct means or sustained by an insured. I mean, those are fairly straightforward, plain, unambiguous terms. And that's exactly what Judge McNulty based his decision on here. Although, as I said, he did explain that the uniform interpretation may be appropriate when interpreting Fidelity bonds. Just getting back to this idea about covered property, since 1980, courts have uniformly held, or at least consistently held, that under the revised language, there is no coverage for third-party liability under Fidelity insuring agreements. There are a few exceptions, and those exceptions you'll see in some of the cases that were presented by the plaintiff in his appeal. One is where the bond was issued pursuant to a statutory scheme, where the statute was enacted to protect a third party, where the bond was issued specifically to fit that statute. That's how that issue came up on summary judgment here. Judge McNulty properly held that this is not a statutory bond for various reasons. Plaintiff is not challenging that, but that's the relevance of that finding. The second type of case, group of cases where courts have found coverage, and as was alluded to by Mr. Lieben this morning, is cases involving covered property. And he cited two of them in his brief. One is RBC and the other is MassMutual. And this is very important, and it's very important for me that Your Honors understand this distinction. And the MassMutual case actually has a great explanation of the history of Fidelity bonds and the reason for covered property, for coverage for property entrusted in the insured's care. That coverage exists because the property itself is insured under the bond. In some Fidelity bonds, it's blended into one insuring agreement. In our bond, it's actually two. There is coverage for theft of property under A1A in the bond. The plaintiff has not made out a case, either on summary judgment or in this appeal, that coverage is triggered under A1A. He's solely seeking coverage under insuring clause A1B. And the reason for that is because there's been no theft of property here. There's been no theft that's proven. This is a failure on the part of the insured to repay promissory notes based on an investment scheme. The other reason is that property, as defined in our bond, is limited to tangible property. So we have a separate insuring agreement that applies to covered property. That insuring agreement was not, plaintiff has not sought to make a case under that insuring agreement. He's waived any, any attempt to do so at this point. But even if he hadn't, he can't, because there is no theft of property here. So the case is readily distinguishable from the MassMutual case and the RBC case. But those cases are still important, because the courts recognized in both of those cases that this distinguishing characteristic of why there was coverage for those invested funds.
Well, let me go back and ask you, counsel. MassMutual and RDC, was one of them a statutory bond? Was one of them a theft? You know, because you haven't told us why they're distinguishable.
Yeah, and thank you for that question, actually. Those did not involve statutory bonds. They involve standard form fidelity coverage. The coverage in those cases was triggered because funds had been invested with the insured company and entrusted to them under their possession and control. And because the bonds in those cases specifically covered that property, so it didn't create a third-party liability coverage, it did in a way, because it created coverage for that liability to the investors.
What was the language that specifically covered that investment, possession of invested money, versus, in our case, possession of invested money?
In that case, the language turned on whether the definition of property in those policies included the funds, the types of funds that were invested with those, with the insured company. So in RBC, you have to look for it. It's actually in a footnote, because they distinguish in a footnote the difference between that case and another case, because they don't explain it in the decision. They actually say there was another case that involved a similar type loss. The distinguishing characteristic was there the plaintiffs were seeking coverage for covered property. And that's the case in MassMutual also. The court said that in MassMutual, some of the outside investors may have coverage. The insured may have coverage for some of the losses to the outside investors because it falls within the property insuring agreement in those policies. And the court in MassMutual very specifically said, I'm not creating a third-party liability coverage here under a fidelity bond. The reason I'm finding coverage is because property that's entrusted with our insured is covered under the bond.
And so I take it that there is no similar language in the bond before us now about property entrusted to the insured?
There is language under our bond for that type of coverage, but it's in our bond a different insuring agreement. It's A1A.
Well, the language we're currently construing and working with does not include that language.
It does not.
What is the language that we would look for to determine when there is covered property?
The language,
when there is not.
There's a separate insuring agreement. So plaintiff is not seeking coverage under that insuring agreement. The language is found under insuring clause A1A, and that's in the bond. And on the record, it is if I've got this right, 0028. I've actually got two numbers here for some reason. I'm not sure what's correct. Or CDP-0000445. That coverage provides coverage for theft of money, securities, or other property by any employee insured, whether committed alone or in collusion with others. Now, the plaintiff has not sought coverage under that insuring agreement.
Is that the link that the coverage was sought under MassMutual?
It's similar language. The difference is under a standard bond. Those two insuring agreements are actually typically one insuring agreement. But yes, that is the language where coverage was sought under MassMutual. The reason MassMutual is instructive is because it specifically says that the reason it's covered is because it's covered property, not because there's coverage under fidelity bonds for third-party liability.
So now tell us, what was the nature of the invested funds in MassMutual that allowed it to be treated as property, whereas here the funds are not to be treated as property?
Well, there's a couple things, Your Honor. Putting aside the waiver issue.
They didn't claim.
Because they've never sought to establish coverage under that insuring agreement. But putting that aside, there's no theft here. There's no allegation of theft. What we have is claims of misrepresentation, fraud, etc. Our insuring clause with respect to property provides coverage for only tangible property, as opposed to the insuring clause in MassMutual, which provided much broader property coverage.
So you only can't have that clause in front of me, and I don't see the word stand.
Yeah, if you go to, you see that property is, first of all, theft is a defined term, and that involves an unlawful taking to the deprivation of the insured. So we're talking about criminal conduct here. But secondly, which was present in the Madoff case, there's no question there that there was a theft. Secondly, the definition of property, which can be found in the definitions section of the bond.
It's tangible property.
Which is on page C0036 or CDP 0000453, you'll see the definition of property is as follows. Property means the following tangible items: currency, coin, banknotes, Federal Reserve notes, etc. So there's a reason why he didn't seek coverage here under that insuring agreement, and there's a reason why that insuring agreement wouldn't apply even if he had. But the reason why it's important is for the court to understand the distinction between what is being claimed here as opposed to what is being claimed in the MassMutual case. I should also point out that MassMutual is not the prevailing, the decision in the MassMutual case about covered property and third-party liability is a decision that is very much in dispute in the industry. There are cases, and we've cited some of them. Lynch Properties is one. Vons is another in California, which is a very famous decision, where courts have said even in, with respect to covered property, first party means first party. They've declined to extend coverage to certain types of invested funds. MassMutual found coverage specifically on that basis, but the reason that that's notable is to point out that even where you have covered property, there are a significant number of cases and decisions in this country that say even in, at that point, you still don't have coverage for third-party liabilities. The last thing I want to say, Your Honor, is just about the issue of...
You're out of time.
I'm sorry.
But I don't know how long you've been out of time. I didn't see the record.
I'm not seeing anything right now. Thank you,
counsel. You have about 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, counsel.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that one of the problems with Lloyd's analysis is we brought an action under 1AB, which is substantially broader than 1A1, requires direct financial loss sustained by the insured for any other dishonest acts by the employee of the insured, whether committed alone or so on, that cause direct financial loss to the insured. We stand in the shoes of the insured. They say we don't, and I'm not sure what the basis for it or what case was cited for that proposition.
I don't think they say that you don't. I think they say that basically the loss you have to measure is not your loss, but CCI's loss.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. And I'll go back to MassMutual then, which kind of combines A1A and A1B. But as you noted, the definition of property did include currency, as counsel read it, and that's what we've invested. And we are not here to seek recovery for our claims directly. we were going to try that if we couldn't get the assignment under the ink or something or another case down in New Mexico. We didn't have to do that because we got the assignment.
That's your theory? You invested currency? Your theory is you invested currency?
Currency
usually means dollar bills to me.
Currency represented by checks or wires. If money is wired from one account to another.
Is currency a defined term in the policy? We'll look. Don't worry. So don't spend your time on accounts.
Okay, thank you. And that's the really fine distinction. We are seeking recovery for the loss to CCI based on the liability that it's incurred by virtue of taking in our money and giving it away to somebody under terms that we had not agreed to in the original arrangement.
Haven't you then converted it to a liability policy on behalf of CCI? Or CCI having a liability policy? Versus a fidelity policy.
Had we brought it as a third party claim, we would have been trying to convert it into a liability policy. And there's a fine line between a liability policy and the claims that are recognized under Mass Mutual and RBC and Continental, where they say it's not a liability policy, it's still a first party claim as long as you're seeking, even if you're seeking losses, even if it's not the embezzlement from the bank, even if you're seeking losses by virtue of wrongful conduct to a third party, you're not seeking recovery of it for the third party, you're seeking recovery of it for the assured, which is CCI, which is why it was so important for us to stand in their shoes.
I want to go back to Mass Mutual here very quickly.
Very quickly. Page 16 of Mass Mutual says it's important to distinguish between claims based on the insured liability for damages caused by an employee's perpetration of fraud on a third party and claims based on the employee's misappropriation of a third party's property while in the possession of the insured. We are the latter, and that makes that distinction. And it goes on to cite a Tenth Circuit case that says there's liability, they're liable to pay those claims for losses against the assured as they are established. Cites another case, Aetna versus Kidder, noting that a third party claim can give rise to coverage when the employee acted dishonestly and the third party's property is taken from or lost by the insureds.
It's no longer the third party's property when they loan it to the company, is it?
Well, and one of the cases we cite addresses that. When the third party gives the property, even if they take back a note or take back collateral, that doesn't undo the losses that they underwent.
But that's an investment loss as opposed to a loss of somebody stealing the property.
Well, there are numerous cases. The Mass Mutual case, I mean, that was the Madoff case. That involved the investment of funds. That's what the case was all about. And numerous of these cases are about people putting money in banks. The FDIC.
I think the Madoff case involved not investing money, but taking money.
Well, people invested money with Madoff. And Madoff eventually, instead of investing that money like he said he was going to, kept money for himself. Here we're alleging in the underlying suit that Matt Witt took our money under false pretenses and use that not to invest under false pretenses, but to loan money to third parties under false pretenses. And I would also commend the Tenth Circuit FDIC case to your honor.
Sir, you two are staring at a red light.
I
understand. So I think the argument's over.
It's the Tenth Circuit FDIC case. It involves, it says that liability alone can be the direct loss. Thank you very much, your honor.
We thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.
Thank you.
Thank you.